A promotional fee has been paid by the sponsor of this program for its editorial content. Statements, views, and beliefs expressed by the sponsor do not reflect those of WOKV or Cox Media Group.
The Consumer Law Hour is brought to you by Farrah & Farrah.
Helping to make our community a better place. This is the WOKV Ask the Experts Weekend, discussing the things that matter most to you. Have a question? Have it answered by our local experts. Call 340-1045. That's 340-1045. Now, the Consumer Law Hour with Eddie and Chuck Farrah on News 104.5 WOKV.
Good afternoon and very happy Saturday to you. You are listening to the Consumer Law Hour brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. Eddie and Chuck here in the studio as always. Phone lines are open 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045. But joining us today, very special guest. You heard him last week. You've been on the show in the studio many times. Mr. Brian Flaherty.
I'm Brian Flaherty, and I'm Flaherty. Glad. That's okay. That's all right. Irish name's very tough, but you better get it right for St. Patrick's Day. Glad to be here once again with Eddie and Chuck.
He'll practice.
That's a deal. Getting it all done.
Tim, I asked Brian to be here today because, you know, he's a former state attorney, and he also worked for the city in the general counsel's office and represented the police for several years before he got into plaintiff's personal injury work. And we had him on the phone last week because I'm really interested in this. Really, this, I mean, there's been a lot. I mean, the Parkland thing, everything.
It's tragic. It's tragic. Absolutely tragic.
There's just so many issues swirling around arising from that, from gun rights to you know, who's responsible and what we should do next. But nobody's really talked about whether anybody is exposed to any kind of civil liability. Like, I mean, can somebody be sued for money damages for what's happened down there? And that's what we were trying to get into last week. You ran out of time. So I asked Brian to get here. I said, under what, I mean, can, you know, there have been allegations of police officers not going into the school.
Correct.
And, you know, community service officers not doing what they were supposed to do.
Absolutely.
I mean, do they, I mean, one guy resigns. I mean, is that just the end of it? I mean, is anybody, can anybody be held responsible for money damages as a result of what's happened out there, considering that you're dealing with a government entity?
Absolutely. You've got two different things to be asking about. First of all, under state law and under federal law, they're distinctively different as to what you have. First of all, under state law, there's caps as to sovereign immunity. The government of Florida allows itself to be sued only in a very limited capacity. And that means that for an event involving two or more people, it's a total of $300,000 without getting a legislative claims bill. And that means just what I said, a legislative claims bill. It has to pass both houses of the legislature.
That means you got to get an actual bill
by the governor.
Passed.
Yes, sir.
You got to go to the legislature.
That's exactly right.
And get a
law.
Bill passed.
It's a law.
Yes, sir.
You
That's
get
exactly
a law
right.
Passed.
You have to get it passed. Very difficult
every
to get a claims bill.
And the,
correct.
And that both houses.
Right.
And, yeah.
Any
okay.
governmental entity is protected by it. It's a very, very limited thing. When I first started practicing back, you and I, Eddie, a long time ago, it used to be 5,100, then it was 100, 200. And within the last few years, it's been raised to the 200, 300 cap, meaning 200 per individual, 300 total. Then you have the federal side of things, which under this one with the police generally will involve the civil rights aspect of things. And that's an area in and of itself. And that's under a federal statute, 42 United States Code 1983. And when I was with the city, I was an assistant general counsel working with the sheriff's office. We handled those kinds of cases regularly, both in federal and in state court.
I want you to take this phone call because it's right on point what
Absolutely.
You're talking about. It's a government case.
Sure.
A slip and fall at the airport. The airport's owned by the city. You're
well, the airport's what? Not owned by the city. The airport is got connections to both state and the city as to the ownership, where she fell and under what circumstances will be a very big deal. So I'd like to hear what it is.
Let's take the phone call. Then I want to come back and ask Brian about Parkland again. But let's get Roseanne while she's on the phone. Roseanne?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. Brian was talking about something that is related to your issue. Go ahead.
It's about the airport. We were coming from the third parking deck, walking over to go to United. It was raining. It's a covered area. It wasn't a whole lot of rain. And I was coming across, and the next thing I know, I'm on the ground in excruciating pain. Apparently, my leg slipped from underneath, my left leg slipped from underneath me all the way over, and I came down on the femur and broke my femur.
We're very sorry to hear that.
I have never broken a bone in my life.
And yes, ma'am.
To break the largest bone in my body was, you know, excruciating.
Very bad fall. No question.
The airport, I got from everybody that those painted lines are always so slippery. People keep saying they have to shimmy across them. Oh, yeah, that's that's all I heard from, you know, it was so slippery. We have a friend that works at Disney, and he said they are constantly upgrading those lines and putting sand in there. And I'm questioning whether the airport had done enough so that I didn't have to slip.
No, you're asking an excellent question. And the answer to that is it's very troubling to think that that was a contributory cause to your injury. If they created the condition, and from what you're describing, it sounds like they did, then they absolutely can be held liable. One of the major things in any slip and fall or trip and fall case is the issue of notice, whether or not it's a defective condition, meaning that you've got a hole in the ground or you've got a crack in a sidewalk or something along those lines, or whether or not it was something that was created by the entity, in this case, by using paint that may have not been appropriate, especially when it gets wet. So what you're talking about is something that we deal with regularity. We retain engineers. There are people who are specialists in going out there and testing and looking at these things. So I would definitely encourage you to give our main line a call and get involved with us so that we could evaluate and find out exactly what's taking place. Hopefully your leg is healed. Hopefully you're not going to have long-term issues with that, but it sounds like it's a very, very serious injury, and I do think it needs to be explored.
Thank you very much. Rosette, I really appreciate that.
Rosette, yes. Hold on, and Scott's going to get your phone number. We're going to call you.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Brent. But Brent, getting back to, thanks, Roseanne. And this is just tied in because it's a government case.
Sure.
Okay, so what about, so the civil rights, there's no limit. You said if it gets the state on a sovereign immunity, is a $300,000 cap.
The state, okay. You can sue for negligence, right, in terms of their actions on an event, right, false arrest, excessive force, things along, right, those lines. You have a cap. If you go after the individual police officer, that creates, right, its own complications because if they're outside course and scope of their employment, which is defined under 768.28, the statute that deals with the negligence, then they could be on their own and the governmental entity could say that they're not. When you go into, and that's on the state law, and the cap is in place, and it creates a lot of complications.
Oh, hold on, let me ask you. So,
sure,
you can sue the individual police officer then.
You,
right,
can, but it has twists to it. If he's outside the course and scope of his job,
yeah, but
then
he's
that
not,
creates
in this
it.
Case, he's probably not.
But if he's inside course, right, and scope of his job, which is what most of them apparently were here, then he has immunity, and then it's the governmental entity, be it the Broward County Sheriff's, right, Office, or be it the school board if they employed these people directly, or somebody else.
So you're still dealing with the $300,000.
That's right. You're still under,
okay,
the same cap.
Okay. All right. So
under state law.
Now, so these individual police officers, they don't have their own insurance in case somebody sues them. Is that correct?
Well, that's, as a general rule, that's correct. Now, what we're finding is in some places, and again, I don't know what the policies of Broward County Sheriff's Office are. I would be greatly surprised as a governmental entity if they had outside insurance. But also, we get back to the issue of the schools. We had, a recent case where we sued a school entity, and they had separate insurance beyond what they were required to have. They're not required to have it, but this one had a separate policy, insurance policy, that was very much part of the litigation that we were seeking a remedy for our client under. And that's a big issue in any case to find out what they have for coverages, okay, beyond their governmental immunity. Because if you sue them and they don't have coverage and the claims bill goes in effect, say, for $1 million, it would come back to them and they would be responsible from whatever budgetary authority they're given to pay that claim. And that's one of the things that we find difficult with jurors to understand, that governmental entities are no different than private corporations. They have to be held to the same standards, right, of responsibility. They can't be negligent. Yeah. They can't be irresponsible. And when they conduct themselves that way, they need to be held accountable in front of a jury.
On the civil rights side of it, do you see a civil rights violation type case here in Broward County? And if you do, explain how that process works.
Sure.
With money and caps and,
sure,
things of that nature.
First of all,
what do you have to prove?
Like, sure, well, yeah, sure.
Let's just get down to it. When you were working with the city,
sure,
how many, you worked there for, you represented the police.
I did.
I mean, was it really, were y'all really in the habit of paying claims? Many claims did y'all really have to pay?
We paid claims quite regularly depending upon the circumstances, okay, of what took place. Because sometimes,
I don't remember any trials or anything.
No, the very few trials. But the last major civil rights trial, to my knowledge, that happened in this town was a shooting over the AT&T building with a woman who was really substantially similar to what this young man apparently is, mentally ill. And she was shot to death by a police officer over the AT&T building. That was back in February of 2001. And I was lead counsel on that case. And that involved, obviously, the issue of a police authority, mental illness, and then following policies and procedures. When you look at this area, it gets...
What were they trying to claim in that case?
Well, what they claimed was excessive force. And each case, when you have it,
In what way?
Well, in that one, the woman was unarmed, but she used a van to drive towards a police officer when he was outside of his car when they were trying to arrest her. But she was mentally ill, and that was something that they didn't make a large issue of in the case, nor did we. But in truth, that affected a lot of things that went on in the course of the case for everybody's actions. But in that case, you had the issues of pursuit. You had the issues of excessive force. You had the issues of training and understanding of mental illness.
Oh, she was driving towards the police officer in her
Yes. At the time he used his weapon to defend himself. And as I've said before, we've talked about the use of force on some of these cases that have gone nationally. And
why didn't he just jump out of the way?
At that moment, he could not because of, it had to do with the way the ground was developed. There was a circular driveway, and he was limited in his ability to reverse back on foot. And she moved in him very suddenly, and he had his weapon out, and he had to defend himself.
So he was outside of his car and so forth?
He was, because they were trying to arrest her. The charge involved was relatively minor. If I remember correctly, it was a trespass charge. And then she was fleeing afterwards. But her mental illness was a contributory factor towards a lot of her reactions to the situation, which, of course, creates its own complications. But when you look at these shooting cases again and again and again, you see the issue of mental illness is all through them. And history is understood about these kind of things too often. And I think there's a lack of training in regards to
that. So what was the outcome of that case that you were...
That one was after careful deliberation, the jury gave us a defense verdict in that case.
So they felt that the police officer nor the department were responsible for
her
death.
That's right. We didn't violate her civil rights under 42 U.S.C. 1983.
Okay, so let's say she had won. I mean, let's say it's a Parkland situation.
Sure.
Do you see a scenario where anyone involved, a victim in the Parkland shooting, could file a civil rights case?
Absolutely.
Based on what?
Well, you've got two different things that are here. And again, we only know what we know from the media, which creates its own complications. But you've got two scenarios with Parkland. Leave aside the school resource officer who resigned the next day. Say as they refer to him in the media, he's the coward. I don't know anything about it, but leave that alone for the moment. The discussion that they kept coming back to is the three officers who were kept outside that did not go in. The officers who went in were in the town right across the way in Coral Springs. They went into the scene immediately. National policy on this is clear and has been that clear for some years, which is that you immediately go into these active shooting scenes to take control. You don't wait for anybody. You go in immediately. Now, at the beginning last week, I didn't know that Broward County had a policy on point, but allegedly, according to the media, their policy was to take immediate action and go into these shooting scenes.
So those three officers were supposed to go inside?
Yes. But allegedly, they were ordered by a superior officer. No one has identified who that said they were supposed to stand and wait for other authority to come to the scene. Now, who gave that order and what's involved, that creates its own issues and very much
what do you mean
so.
Other authority? Like another backup or something?
No, a superior officer.
Okay. Okay.
Police or paramilitary, they follow orders.
All right, so let's get back into that one.
Absolutely.
The phone lines are open, 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045. Eddie and Chuck here in the studio, as well as Brian Flaherty. Don't go anywhere. Brian Flaherty joining the Consumer Law Hour right here on News 104.5
WOKB. I tell you, Tim, I got a head full of ideas driving me insane right now.
I can hear.
Because we were over the break, we were just talking about there's so many issues, many angles to this case. Brian, I want to ask you about the civil rights part of it.
Sure.
If there's a civil rights, and you were telling me over the break that there's no limit, there's no cap.
Absolutely.
Okay, you get attorney's fees, you can get all kinds of, there's no limit on the damages.
That's right.
If you win a civil rights case, but they're difficult.
They are.
You talked about the one that you tried years ago.
Right.
But let me ask you this. I want you to finish that. Then
sure.
I want you to get into... What about the complaints that were made prior to the shooting where they were calling the police department and
sure.
they never acted? Is there a liability because they did not act on the phone calls?
Sure. As a general rule regarding those kind of complaints, they have immunity. As a general rule.
Right.
But the question is, what were the nature of the complaints and what kind of notice did they have of his propensities? For example, some of the stuff was nebulous. Oh, he said some things and he's generalized some things, which is one thing. Other instances, allegedly, and again, we haven't seen all the details of the paperwork, it involved him actually taking a firearm and pointing it at somebody. That's a felony, no question about it. But they didn't pursue it. Now, why it was not pursued, either by the police to make an arrest or the state attorney's office to follow through and go ahead and charge, remains to be seen. There's a lot of very good unanswered questions about his history, just like when they brought to the FBI's attention his propensities of being a school shooter, and there was no follow-through to even do a preliminary investigation.
Yeah, okay. There's no liability on them, though, right?
Same thing. I don't know yet. I don't know what the full story is or why they did not from their complaint hotline take it to the next step in regard to an individual agent. I don't know what their policies or procedures are, but they're held accountable under the same federal statute as would the Broward County Sheriff's Office.
What about this scenario? You've heard them before. Husband and wife going through divorce. There's some abuse going on. The wife gets an injunction for protection.
Sure.
She calls the police. My husband's getting ready to come over and beat me up, or he's threatening to kill me. And the police just don't show up.
Well,
and he comes over and does something to her.
There's a lot in the domestic situation, and they're very complicated. There's a lot of back and forth on those. Now, if she has an injunction and he's actually at the scene and the police find him there, he's going to jail. Yeah. And the allegation in the old days, it used to be for the police that the allegation of being abused was not enough. Not these days. If you're at the scene of a domestic dispute and you've been alleged to have hit a woman, or she's alleged to have hit you, because it's supposed to be both sides, but I think it should be even more so to protect the rights of a woman, considering the history in this country, you're going to jail. And they're going to arrest you, and they're going to charge you for that, because they're not going to take any chances. And we've seen so many tragedies that have happened as a result of that domestic abuse, and the enforcement of the law in that area has gotten very aggressive, as it should have been.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the civil rights component of this case, because that's what I'm really interested in.
Sure.
Were these victims' civil rights violated?
Well,
and so how are you going to prove? Let's go back to the policy.
It has to do with the timeline. One of the things to ask about in this case, and we were talking about this off, as to would it have made a difference by the time the Broward County Sheriff's Office had arrived at the scene if these three officers were held back by the orders of a superior officer in violation of their policy. If they were held back, would it have made a difference at the scene? I don't know. We're going to have a timeline that's going to be established. We talked about this as a general sense last week, and I said the timeline's so important, and that's why I said file an internal affairs complaint. Sure. Well, that was last Saturday. On Sunday, the governor ordered the FDLE to do a complete investigation, and they'll establish a complete timeline. So until we get defined answers, we're going to be speculating about many things. But if they could have made a difference. I'm sorry?
Timeline being more like, when did they arrive?
Absolutely.
If
they
shooter inside?
That's right.
In the school?
That's right. That's right, because he left the scene with an Uber driver. If he was already gone by the time they arrived, then obviously it would not have made a difference whether they were ordered to hold back or not. But if they could have made a difference, and again, we just don't know about the time.
How can they prove that?
They're going to show moment by moment. They have videotape.
So
they have everything. They'll know.
Absolutely,
they will know.
Because they had to get into the school. They had to find him.
Yep.
And then
they'll track him step by step.
And
exactly.
Then,
what rooms, everything.
And they'll know exactly how long it's
going
to take. Okay, so they can figure out.
Exactly.
Okay.
Trust me, they will have it all figured out.
All right, we're going to talk some more about this.
Okay.
If there's anybody in law enforcement listening and they want to weigh in on these issues, feel free to call.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear
They've caught a lot of grief about this, and I just think it's unfair if they were ordered to hold back.
904-340-1045
we'll
is
Dave
the phone number.
We'll
be back. Welcome back to the Consumer Law Hour right here on News 104.5 WOKV, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. Brian Flaherty here in the studio with us. Phone lines are open, 904-340-1045, 904-340-1045. We have Dave in Mandarin. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hey, Dave.
Yes, sir. How you doing, sir?
Fine.
I got a question in regard to an intentional torque. If you on the job working and a subcontractor for who you working for take an image or a picture of you and send that picture to your superiors for the intent of harming you, how can they lawfully send an image of you without your permission over the internet or just by phone?
Well, I mean, is there an expectation of privacy when you're on the job? You're out in public. People can take a picture of you.
They can.
Yeah.
Is, you're asking a couple different questions. How were you harmed?
Yeah.
as a response to that, written up on the job and had a situation where I had to sign some documentation, and there was an expectation of privacy in the area.
Well, I don't know that on the job you have any expectation of privacy anywhere except a bathroom. I mean, if you're in a cubicle, if you're in a work area, you're all fair game. But also, if they caught you doing something that was contrary to your employer's policies, you're also fair game.
Okay. I didn't know if they could really send an image of you without your permission.
Yes, they can. What they can't do is record you secretly, to record your voice secretly in conversations about things that you wish had not been recorded. To record your voice is a different situation than filming you.
Yeah, okay.
We have this all the time with our clients who are surveilled. They follow them around and they go ahead and they film them. Yeah, exactly. They don't have them record their voice, but you're fair game when you're out there out and about. You have no expectation of privacy when you're out and about. The only place that you have an expectation of privacy is inside your own home or in a bathroom.
Or you're on telephone call can't be
telephone. Recorded. No. Audio is different than visual. Yeah. I'm talking about pure visual. Yeah, yeah. Audio 100%. Yeah. They can't be recording.
Right. He's right. Brian's right.
Illicitly.
You're in public. I mean, you don't have in your home and somebody's snooping around and photographs, one thing. But being out in the public in the job.
On the job, you're fair game. Your employer can have access to a lot of things that you couldn't believe, including your emails on the job when your employer's computer and other things. You know.
Well, I know. With the email, there are no expectation of privacy. But a subcontractor that works for the same organization that you work for, if the contract that they sign with it prohibits them from doing that, I don't know what that contract is because I haven't got a copy of it. But once I get a copy of it, how can I get a copy of that contract to see if there is any restrictions on what they can do? Because it might be something in the contract that restricts them from coming after an employee of their organization.
You're talking about two different things. One is you assume that there's a contract, and number two, you assume there's something in the contract that gives you a right of privacy on the job. And I can assure you that I find that very difficult to believe that would ever take place. But you can always talk to your employer about any contract you think would apply. But I'm telling you in advance, I really doubt there's anything there about the right of privacy that protects you or anyone else. I've never seen such a thing.
Okay, and how would I get a copy of that contract?
You talk to your employer. Anybody you work for, if you're under an employment contract, if you're part of that, you have the right to do that. If you belong to a union, if you're covered by your union, you go back to your union representative and ask him about a copy of the contract. But before you look, I'm telling you in advance, regarding things like that for privacy in the workplace, other than the bathroom, I'm not seeing it.
Dave, you can go to HR. Maybe they can help you. But I think Brian's right on. All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks
man. Good luck.
Good luck.
Brian, you're getting back to this, what we're talking about, the civil rights.
Sure. Again.
Now, what do you got? Okay. We've talked about, the cap, the $300,000 and so forth. For state.
Under state law. Negligence and other related issues. Civil rights.
Is civil rights case a federal case?
Yes.
Is that filed in federal court?
It's federal or state court.
You can file
jurisdiction
in
either one, but they can remove you to U.S. District Court.
Okay.
A lot of times they do because strategically a lot of lawyers don't like litigating in federal court. But coming back to it, the federal statute, 42 U.S.C. 1983, is not a glorified negligence statute. It means very specific things. There has to be a violation of a policy, practice, custom, or procedure that was causally related to the violation of your civil rights, equal protection, or something else that's there.
So they have
to have that very much in place. So if you had a policy in place that was clearly violated by the sheriff's office, by orders of it, and it resulted in the death or injury to other people, they've got themselves a very serious potential problem. But we don't know all the details yet to make such an assumption.
Yeah. And so you have potentially 17, even the people who were injured. Yeah,
absolutely. Claims. Everybody that was otherwise affected or received any injuries, a lot of them were wounded that have made, hopefully, God willing, good recoveries. But until you see the timeline and everything that's there, and they will have it moment by moment figured out exactly what's taken place before this is done, it's going to have it will be speculation to be talking about how it would apply.
I mean, how long do you have to file that civil rights lawsuit against the county or the sheriff's office?
The one against the state is 4 years, and generally when the statute is for 42 U.S.C. 1983, they look to state law, which in Florida will allow you, I believe, up to 4 years to go ahead and pursue it.
You got time.
Have time to pursue a civil rights claim along those lines. But again, it is a very, very difficult case to prove if you don't have the underlying policy violation. But the first thing I thought was, did they not have a policy in place? And then when I heard that a superior officer stopped them from going in violation of their policy, I thought, somebody's got some explaining to do, very, very serious explaining to do about why that was done. Because if that happened and they could have made a difference in that shooting situation, that's going to have ramifications.
Yeah, but even if they violated a policy and the policy violation wouldn't have made a difference, they would have been shot anyway, then there's no claim. Correct?
Well, I don't know that has to do with causation, and
so,
I don't know
the
that
the state's going to argue, even though
it was over before we arrived.
Yeah, it was over before we arrived.
I understand.
I mean, everybody, the shooting was over.
I understand.
Or 15 of the 17 were already dead before the time we got in there.
Correct,
that's
begin. That's why I said, in most instances, you don't have the governor, as he did last Sunday, ordering the FDLE to do a detailed investigation on this. So when you have a suspicion that there was an impropriety under policy, practice, or procedure of a department, what you should do is, on behalf of whoever has been affected, be it an arrest situation or be it an interaction with a police officer that resulted in injuries or something along those lines, file an internal affairs complaint. By law, they're supposed to investigate it. It's confidential until it becomes a public record, and then you can go ahead and see exactly what their position is after talking to these things.
All right, so right now what you've just said is, let's say somebody here in Jacksonville feels like they were a victim of some sort of police misconduct.
Sure.
Any citizen can file that
Absolutely.
Complaint?
And I should encourage them to do so. The Internal Affairs Unit, the Sheriff's Office, did a very thorough job in regard to investigating these things and making sure that the officers were either in course and scope and in following mm-hmm. procedures of the department, or they're not. And when they find violations, they take appropriate action, or they okay. did certainly when during the time I was there
right.
under Sheriff Glover and under Sheriff McMillan. And I've found that they were very, very serious about making sure that officers who act inappropriately or violate these procedures, especially on the serious ones, they're no longer employed as police officers. They lose their job and their certification. Because if you lose your job, you could still keep your certification and go to another department. But to have the certification removed means you can't serve as a police officer statewide. But it depends on what the circumstances of it were.
What do you mean you go to a different department?
Sure.
Let's say they find you violated something. And you take away your job as a police, you're like,
they fire you. Sure.
Okay, but you still have your certification
That's
as a
right.
police officer?
That's right. So they'll make the state aware of it. The state can keeps your certification.
Right.
The state can go ahead and remove it. Sometimes in the more serious cases, they can surrender their certification, to avoid as part of a criminal prosecution situation in which they steal or which they do something with illegal narcotics or something else.
Right.
That can be part of a plea deal that they give up their certification and won't have it restored so they can never go work as a police officer
right.
again. And also that'll be surrendered to the state as well as their job. So that's part of what the negotiations can be in some of these instances.
Okay. All right. Now getting back to what we touched on before. This before all this happened, the 30 phone calls or whatever it was, the complaints to both the FBI and to the sheriff's office.
Broward County Sheriff's
Office. Broward County, about this person's actions or what they thought he was going to do.
Sure.
All that, I mean, that stuff's public knowledge, right?
It is.
Will people be able to get it?
They will.
I mean,
it's all public record.
It is, but nobody's got it yet. I haven't heard anything.
Do they have
a timeline to renew it?
And FDLE will be right. working on that right now. The information about that will not be specifically released date and time unless the media's gotten a hold of it. And again, they'll make what's called a Chapter 119 public records request.
Mm-hmm.
And under Chapter 119.
What is that? Explain to our listeners what a
sure.
public.
Sure.
Because anybody can do this,
that's
right?
That's exactly right. You can send an email or in the old days, write a letter and ask them under a Chapter 119 public records request in the state of Florida for information pertaining to and whatever your subject may be. Now, there are some things that you're not going to get a hold of. An active investigation will, by law, be privileged, and they will not tell you what's going on criminally or, in this case, what's going on with him. But once the investigation is complete or a criminal case is completed, then you can get that information. And that's in any situation involving any kind of a criminal case.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very valuable tool to certainly understand the information the police had, what they were told, and what everybody says. And a lot of it is under oath. And that's a big deal when they're sworn police reports.
Yeah, but sometimes, we use this information. We try to get 411 calls for, auto
sure.
accidents and things.
Sure.
I mean, isn't there a time limit? Because a lot of times
there is.
If you wait, they erase them or they're gone. They don't keep them forever.
In the old days, they kept them for a certain period of time because they used to keep them on tape and otherwise.
Right.
It has been some years since I was familiar with what the updated technology is with everything being digitized these days, whether it's in the cloud, whether it's preserved forever. So I would not be the right one to answer the specifics of what they're able to preserve today versus when I was doing this work some years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But now when people are involved in accidents, something we do request a 411 tapes and
sure.
so forth. Yeah, and those are available.
Yep. And sometimes they're very helpful to help identify somebody who's at the scene who we can't otherwise track down that was not on a police report. But in many instances, the people that are calling are the drivers that were affected.
Mm-hmm.
And the driver's statements, as you well know, are protected under the accident report privilege
right.
for statements that are given.
Yeah, this case is a little different.
Go ahead. Go
sure.
finish up.
The accident report privilege is very misunderstood. As a general rule in accident cases, you're required by law to speak to the police officer. And that's the same as when they ask you and they give you a ticket to sign off on the ticket. People say, I'm not signing the ticket. You say, listen. By signing the ticket, you're not acknowledging your guilt. You're acknowledging acceptance of the ticket. Then you can go to court if you want to. If you don't do it, then it's going to lead to something worse, which is potentially your arrest. Same thing with they have this. The civil side of it requires you to speak to the police officer, tell them exactly what happened as a public policy reason, and that's to the drivers. Witnesses are separate. They're totally outside. But you're required by law to cooperate with the police officer. And in return, that means at a later point, they can't use those statements against
right.
you.
The public policy.
Can't. Yep. It's absolutely inviolate, and it has implications for us.
The Parkland shooting is really a lot different than that
Las
Vegas mass shooting.
Because, sure.
But you still had some police involvement there in the Las Vegas shooting, because remember there was questioning, they were questioning whether they responded in time and
right.
whether they handled that situation correctly. But what's different is you've got this private casino
sure.
that's now could be on the hook because they had their own security.
That was where he operated out of. That's where he fired from. The question is he had firearms all throughout his room and he'd been back and forth for a
right.
period of time. What did they know? What should they have known?
You're right.
Knew or should have known. And I believe at
it's
least
much
one,
different, easier case.
Absolutely. And one hotel in Vegas right now, I think it's the Wynn, has completely changed their policy about that your private can't enter is going to be very much not followed to some degree. It's going to allow people to go access the room and look around, see if there's anything
right.
that's there. I don't know how that's going to be carried out because you're weighing the privacy interests of a guest versus the right of the hotel to know what kind of activities you might be engaged
yeah.
in there.
Yeah.
He amassed a bunch of weapons yeah. that I think anybody going in that room to clean it would have been able to
yeah,
pick up on fairly quickly.
Yeah, that's what got
Absolutely. It got very little attention, but I think that's being explored right now by a number of people.
It was a suite, so it was a big room.
Yeah.
He could have pieces of luggage
right.
scattered around.
And he brought his guns up and his weapons, his ammunition and other things up there slowly over a period of time
yeah.
and put it together.
Right.
Because to conduct himself that way, he didn't just fire some pistol at the distance he was at. He had some very large, very powerful weapons
sure.
that required a period of time to bring it up. And if they'd done more than a cursory cleaning, they might have picked up on that if they inspected the room. So there's a question of what did they do or should have done versus the right of privacy when you say, I don't need my room clean, leave me alone. So you're going to have interesting national implications on these
kind
of issues.
Yeah, I think the things we've been talking about today, the civil rights potential violation
right.
and the sovereign immunity, whether the sheriff
sure.
or the school board can be sued.
Different situation
this
entirely.
This is going to be coming up in the near future. I mean,
right.
nobody's really talked about it.
Right.
But I think you're going to hear I don't think people are going to just sit back and say, okay, it's over. We're grieving, and it's just going to let it go.
The major thing that doesn't seem to ever be addressed is being proactive in these situations, because obviously we're wonderful in hindsight at recognizing all these things. But if it had been dealt with in a proactive fashion, if somebody had sat down and said, you know, we got 30 complaints, we got FBI complaints, he owns these weapons, he's exhibited these behaviors, he's threatened people, he's done this, he's done that. Maybe somewhere along the lines, charges should have been brought. It could have been brought at any time.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhere along the line, some action should have been taken.
But
and I think in hindsight, we see that, but actually at the time, it was not occurring because there was a lack of communication.
But Brian, I don't know, because I'm not involved in police enforcement or anything, but they probably
sure.
get thousands of phone calls.
They do.
I bet some people could just call. Oh, my neighbor's crazy.
They do.
You know, he's got a gun and
right.
I just don't like the way he's acting.
Right.
Or he's
and
acting nervous or he's acting.
But I would ask you, this question.
You could have a whole force just reacting to every phone call.
See that that way.
No,
What I ask is you got leading up to this, he's had 30 separate occasions. You had multiple reports to the FBI.
Right.
At what point does somebody not sit down and pick up on that this
right.
might be a problem? This is somebody who'd been expelled from school. This
right.
is somebody who is in possession legally of a number of weapons, including the AR-15. Somewhere along the line, if the pieces had been put together, you might have asked the question, where's this all going to go?
Yeah.
19 years old.
Yeah.
Troubling.
When we get back, I think we have a couple of minutes.
Sure.
I want to ask you about how you would defend him if you were his lawyer.
Oh, that should be interesting. The Consumer Live Hour right here on News 104.5 WOKV, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. Welcome back. The Consumer Law Hour right here on News 104.5 WOKV.
Yeah, Brian, we have a couple of minutes left.
Sure.
How would you defend Cruz? I mean, if you're his lawyer, what's your plan of attack in terms of trying to keep him off, off of death row?
Well, there's no question. You look at this as it's mental health, mental health, mental health.
Yeah.
That's the key to understand his history. And all that has come out reinforces the idea that this is a person who had some form of limited capacity, which what the law is going to look at. And again, very difficult these cases with most juries to claim not guilty by reason of insanity. But his mental health history is obviously one that I think a jury is going to understand is find to be very troubling.
What if the judge finds he can't participate in the trial because he's not mentally able to do that.
I mean, I don't know that he lacks capacity for his own defense and the other things that are there. The interesting part will in the next few weeks.
And what happens if he's found not guilty by reason of insanity?
Well,
what
happens to him? Then by reason of insanity, he'll be committed to a mental institution until such time as he restores his sanity, which is something you've seen, I think, the man who tried to assassinate President Reagan all those years ago, and then the other people who have gone after famous people as well. They, in the case of that person, they were released after they were determined that with medication they could have some form of control on the outside, and there was a lot of opposition to that because of what had happened. He very seriously injured a number of people beyond the president at the time, and Mr. Brady was out of jail. And it was not jail. He was in a mental institution.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
but the same thing applies. If you get your mental health restored, they look at it as an illness rather than a criminal act. And again, that's our society. And whether or not this is successful in this instance remains to be seen. And that gets back to dealing with the issue of mental illness again. You know, in not so many years ago, they used to be committed institutions. And then there was a great deal of civil rights advocacy on their behalf because of abuses in these institutions to release them. And you've got a lot of people. We go down the streets downtown Jacksonville someday. You see them talking to themselves and you see other things when they're not on medication and their mental illness is not being controlled. And the vast majority, of course, are not violent. But the capacity for that, we had that happen recently in our firm.
Yeah.
We had someone wandering off the street and terrified the firm for a while until the police had to come for someone who was mentally ill. It's very troubling.
Yeah. So that's your strategy on that?
Absolutely. There's no denying the act. You have to get
back from childhood.
Absolutely.
Bring up everything.
Sure, everything. You look at the history of it, very troubling overall, and this is probably what they're building right now for a case. And I think they're going to have a great deal of success with it.
Yeah, you're right.
Truly.
I think that's the defense in that case.
Very sad for the families. Yeah. This is just a tragedy. There's no good about any of this.
Well, Brian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Consumer Law Hour brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. Your news update coming up next. Brian Middleton in the traffic center with a look at your drive heading out to the beaches. Scott Kushner behind the boards producing the show. My name's Tim Tompkins. We'll be back next week at noon.